This is Decentralized, the Decentralized Trials and Research Podcast. We gather here with friends and guests to talk about the latest ways to make research and clinical trials around the world more inclusive, more accessible, more resilient, and more sustainable, all by using decentralized methods. This podcast is recorded live on Clubhouse every Friday, 12 to 1 Eastern, on the TGIF DCT show at the Decentralized Trials Club. You can join the live sessions and add your voice every Friday at noon Eastern time with the free Clubhouse app by following the Decentralized Trials Club. And of course, subscribe to this podcast on your favorite platform to get notified of new episodes. Following the club and subscribing will also help you stay current for any of the bonus content we may drop. And now, it's time to decentralize. Hello and welcome for those of you, whether joining us here live on TGIF DTRA, or for those of you who may be joining us streaming at a later time through your favorite podcast platforms. It's a pleasure to have you back here for this week's TGIF DTRA. Remember, we do gather here many Fridays, not all Fridays, but many Fridays. And we love having these conversations with members of the community who have interesting data, interesting experiences, interesting initiatives, interesting new capabilities that they may be bringing forward, whether it's around leveraging decentralized elements that can improve access, other digital strategies that are moving forward to streamline and bring greater efficiency to the clinical trial process. So keep that in mind. If friends in your organization have something that you'd like to bring forward on TGIF DTRA, just reach out. The easiest way is drop an email to secretariat@dtra.org, or you can feel free to drop a note to myself, Jane Miles, Amir Kulali, through LinkedIn, or however else you like to reach people on the interweb. I'm really excited about today's conversation. We have two friends here from Duke University. We're going to talk a bit about the iCubed organization at Duke to set this up so that we can understand kind of what and where and how they're incubating some of these new opportunities. But then we're really going to focus on one particular opportunity, Project Loom, which is going to be a nice way for us to kind of actualize a lot of the hype and rhetoric and conversation around AI and agentic in clinical trials. Is there really a future of little robots scurrying around and running and designing our studies for us? Or what is this kind of model starting to actually look like from organizations and investigators that are kind of putting these machines to the test? Jane, is that a pretty fair setup for our conversation today?
That sets the tone perfectly. And I was really excited when you agreed to join because I heard a little bit about the project when you were talking about it in May, and I got super curious. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Fab. Well, with that, why don't we get started by meeting our two guests today. We have Donna Parker and Christoph Hornick, both from Duke University, but with different hats and day jobs over there. Donna, maybe you could get us started. Introduce, if you don't mind, yourself and what it is that you're doing over there at iCubed that sort of gives us the foundation for this conversation on Project Loom.
Sure. Happy to be here. And thank you for inviting us. We look forward to the conversation ahead of us. So my name is Donna Parker, and I am the operations director for iCubed, which is the Center for Clinical Research Innovation at the Duke Clinical Research Institute. And iCubed stands for Imagine, Incubate, Ignite. And we serve essentially as an incubator for all things clinical research enablers for the DCRI. The idea being that the Duke Clinical Research Institute, which is the largest and the oldest academic research organization in the country, has identified solutions to problems in clinical research that make trials faster, make them more efficient, and make them more accessible. And that we take some of those solutions and we incubate them in at the DCRI with the idea of sharing them with the world, either through commercialization or some other mechanism. And so we have created over the last 2 years sort of a incubation methodology where we again take these ideas and really build them up and do things like customer discovery and other tasks in order to get them ready to share with the world.
It's great to hear that, organizations that are so well respected in clinical research like Duke, you've basically created a front door for innovators and entrepreneurs to be able to engage and to be able to provide that type of access to experts that can kind of help move these opportunities forward in a disciplined way. So it's great to meet you here, Donna. I've obviously met you before, but I love letting and making sure others in the community have that same opportunity. And then, Amir?
Sure, I just have a quick question just for our audience to sort of understand. So, Donna, am I understanding correctly that this is also external people coming to be incubated there, sort of to learn from the methodologies, or is it all Duke generated from DCRI?
Right now it's Duke generated, but we partner a lot with the other organizations. So there are other organizations that have incredible ideas, and we have the opportunity to pilot those at DCRI, and we've set that up so that it really depends on the tool or the product or the service that we're looking at, but there's opportunities for external groups to pilot their solutions at the DCRI.
And do you think you're pretty unique in this? Are you aware of any other academic CROs or commercial CROs that have anything similar to this?
I don't know of any at all. No, and
Great.
yeah, and we actually thought, I mean, this was sort of catalyzed around the idea that clinical trials are the basis for all of our drug and device, in the U.S. All of the development, and that they're universally known as too slow, too expensive, and not inclusive. And so the idea around that was, to help facilitate the solutions to that.
Sure. No, I always say we don't spend almost nothing on our research of our research methodologies, whereas other industries do. So,
Right.
fantastic. Thank you.
A great way to phrase the space and the unmet need there, research on the research. And with that, Christoph, I'm delighted to welcome you as well. Also over at Duke, a different hat you wear by day. If you don't mind, Christoph, introduce yourself for folks that haven't had the pleasure.
Yeah, thank you, Craig, and thank you to the whole DTRA team for having us at this. So my name is Christoph Hornig. As Craig suggested, my daytime hat is that I'm a pediatric cardiologist and ICU doctor, and I'm a pediatric clinical trialist. And I've been that for the last, dozen years or so. And I've done a variety of different types of clinical trials, different sponsors, different patient populations, mostly pediatrics, but not all. And I've done a number of sort of trial adjacent, evidence generation type of projects, and some, attempts at trial innovation. And I think because the pediatric space in particular is challenged not just by, too slow, too expensive trials, but I think also by personally not enough trials to answer some of the really meaningful questions that are technically should be simple answers. There's simple questions, there should be simple yes, no answers, but we don't have the infrastructure to really generate that evidence at a scale, at a cost, at a, speed that is compatible with, how healthcare moves along and how people who practice healthcare want to make decisions. Because of those frustrations, I think is why I got really interested in this idea of research on research, as Amir just said, and this idea of identifying potential innovation opportunities. And so I joined the IQ team as one of their associate directors a few years ago. with that sort of interest in mind. You know, can we learn from what we try to do every day, the studies that we try to do? And I think that's really the big strength, not just within DCRI, but within other academic organizations or non-academic organizations for that matter, that don't really have that outlet for innovative ideas, experiences that could be translated into tools or best practices or any kind of other, next steps. I think that's really what iCubed is about, is trying to provide that kind of outlet for a whole lot of people in our organizations who have a lot of good ideas in ours and in other organizations, and just need to find a way to bring these to the broader, audience.
So I have to ask, Christoph, I hear folks like yourself that provide that type of introduction and background, and sometimes I'm kind of overwhelmed, right? You're pediatric intent cardiac intensivist, you're a clinical trialist, you're working with iCubed on new innovations. Do you have like a digital twin of yourself, or how do you are you using AI to kind of like help you manage this breadth of things, or how do you kind of keep all these wheels in motion?
Well, I mean, the main thing I don't have, I mean, I'll tell you about the AI tools in a second. The main thing I have is human intelligence tools, meaning colleagues and partners and a whole bunch of people at DCRI to get this done. That's first and foremost. So, we're very lucky. We're an organization that's, a combination of people like myself. I think we pride ourselves, or we believe it's important to have the connection to the clinical space when it comes to, again, designing clinical trials, thinking about research, creating tools that are really helpful to answer the question that clinicians and patients and families have. So, the entire organization at DCRI kind of functions with people like me who do things like I do and have a foot in the clinical space and the care delivery and a foot in the clinical research, whether that be executing on trials, generating evidence, or doing the research on research or both. But that's possible because we have people like Donna and a whole team who help us get stuff done when we get distracted by some of our other roles. And that's really what it comes down to, is we have to sort of figure out how to get the days moving ahead, the projects moving ahead, even when we, as clinicians, kind of disappear for a day or a week at a time on clinical service. That said, we do use AI quite a bit. AI helps, and I think that's really the premise for Project Loom, is that AI can help. It's not there to replace, it's not there to, get people out of their jobs, but it's really there to help address some of the bottlenecks that we all have. And certainly I've got plenty on my own, and it's helped me in a number of different ways, which I'm happy to talk about.
So Amir had set this question up earlier about where do these projects come from that iCubed is touching? Are they from the external environment, from internal clinicians and investigators? This sounds like one that was a little more organic within Duke in terms of being a challenge that you were looking to tackle. So what exactly was the challenge that you were hoping to tackle here with Project Loom?
I guess I'll get a start on this answer and let Donna chime in, because I think sometimes what we notice is that defining what the problem is and what the challenge is to tackle is really, activity number one, two, and three, and is not always as easy. And getting consistent answers and agreement on that is not always as straightforward as you would think. But I think, what Project Loom was really an experiment to say, can AI help with the execution, the operational execution of clinical trials, and can it do it? So that was really question number one: is it possible? And then, if it can do it, does it help with things like speed? Does it help with things like ease of execution? And then, can it do it in a way that is sufficiently good? And we can talk about how we define sufficiently good, to be a potential real viable path forward. I think some of the principles, if you will, of our questions were that we wanted to try to take a big swing or a big chunk out of the operational workflow of a clinical trial. So we didn't necessarily think that we needed to tackle everything from soup to nuts, because there's no real definition of what everything is in clinical trial operation. I think it depends on the type of trial, depends on the type of patient population, but there's so many variabilities that you can't do everything. But we wanted to take a real big chunk, not just one specific task, and see how AI can help with one specific clinical trial operational task. So the idea was multiple tasks to show the ability of AI to take agents, tools, inputs from one task to the other, and carry it forward in an appropriate manner. And then, again, measuring the quality of what the AI creates, how fast it creates it, and how often humans interface with it and what that looks like. So it was really an experiment. And because it was an experiment, we first designed something, which was this platform or these platforms that are Project Loom, and then we tested them. And that was a clinical trial simulation, not a live clinical study, but a clinical trial simulation that, as you guys might like, was really designed like a decentralized clinical trial to try to capture how well the platform would function in that scenario.
So it sounds like there's this observation along the way that there are a lot of incremental agentic solutions out there and AI-powered solutions for different parts of the clinical trial process. But here you were looking to almost show the power of more of an orchestrated, a bit more end-to-end process. Can we stitch together across these different otherwise interesting point solutions? And in doing so, is there a greater good that's achieved in terms of process efficiency, quality, or otherwise? And did that in the context of a clinical trial that just happened to be a simulated study for purposes of this project? Did I kind of repeat that correctly, or did I miss the mark anywhere?
That's exactly correct. I'll just add two quick things. But one is that the orchestration to us was important because I think you and your audience all are very familiar with the number of point solutions that were pre-AI that were created for clinical trial operations, each of which claimed to somehow revolutionize the process. And while some of these solutions have clearly helped address some bottlenecks, I think anybody who currently does clinical trial and really is, boots on the ground, enrolling patients, collecting data, entering data, et cetera, will probably attest to the fact that the number of point solution creates an ecosystem that sometimes is completely unmanageable and very difficult to navigate. So I think the same risk exists with AI. The benefit is that the orchestration might be in some ways, and I'm not an AI engineer, so I have to be careful with the statement, but in some ways easier or more feasible. And I think that's really what we try to test. And then the second sort of clarifying point I would make is about, while you are absolutely correct that our testing was a clinical trial simulation, we did have the luxury at DCRI of designing that simulation off of a real clinical trial. So what we did is we took a clinical trial that was previously conducted by DCRI in one of our networks. It was completed, it was written up, the CSR existed, the manuscripts derived from it existed. And we took that, modified it slightly for the purpose of the simulation, mostly around time, compressing the time, and then executed the simulation off of that clinical trial, which then allowed us to compare the outputs of the AI platform supported trial to the outputs of the humanly conducted, human conducted clinical trial previously.
Jay and Amir, I have 101 questions digging deeper into what specifically Christoph and the team targeted, what worked, what didn't work along the way, and where this all goes in terms of gaps to address in the space. What questions, Jay and Amir, do you want to bring to Christoph before I monopolize his mind share here?
I mean, just as you all of us have lots of questions, but maybe just to for the audience to understand, how were these agents built, where they come from? Like, just basic understanding of that.
So I'll try to give a brief overview maybe of what ultimately we built. So again, this was an experiment first and foremost. And so we built actually two separate platforms and then tested them both. We didn't do a, it wasn't directly a head-to-head comparison. The goal was not to, pick a winner by any stretch, but was to compare a little bit two different approaches to going about this problem. Each platform was built in partnership with a commercial vendor. And this is where we had some distinctions. One of the vendor was more experienced in clinical research operations and maybe slightly newer to the AI, just like everybody, I suppose, was to the AI tools and AI-enabled clinical trial operation space. And then the other vendor was really an AI agent developing vendor with less experience in clinical trials and clinical trial operations. So we partnered with each. It was sort of, there were parallel work streams, and we built two platforms. Partnering really meant that people at DCRI, myself, Donna, many others on the team, people with real hands-on, boots on the ground, clinical trial operations experience, worked with essentially engineers at each of those companies in parallel to figure out how to train agents that were built on their respective companies' platforms. They used, I would say, relatively traditional tools to train agents and to verify the outputs and all those kinds of things, access to the typical large language models that we know, and then other connections into other sources of data through various, typical sort of AI agent building processes that are not specific to clinical research at all.
Can you,
And then
for our audience who may not be that familiar, perhaps, what kinds of things were they trained on? Like specifically, kind of.
it's a great question. So they were trained on a lot of our process documents. They were trained on a lot of publicly available guidance documents. So, obviously FDA guidances and templates, other agencies and other organizations, I should say, guidance or best practice documents. They were trained a little bit during the iterative sort of process on actually the different clinical trial protocols. So we could sort of do sort of an incremental, learning. And then they were trained on some of our, human inputs on that we would record in conversation, et cetera, on, what should happen next, how it should happen. It was really trying to, and you could argue that is a weakness of the approach. I think that would be a fair criticism. They were trained to try to really replicate the human workflow of clinical trials. So a combination of documents existing, some of us were our DCRI ones, some of us were publicly available, and human input, on how the workflows look. Were really the main sources of training.
And I'll ask you a compound question, which I hate to do normally. But if you think about that process, one of the upsides I see absolutely for protocol development is kind of historically, there's been this kind of meme of a bunch of old men sitting in an ivory tower writing a protocol that is not has anything to do with the real world, right? So one upside I can see from agents is that you can have input such as patient perspectives and other things, or clinicians on the ground perspective that maybe some entities who develop these protocols traditionally may have not done a good job of kind of incorporating. So I can see the upside of that for agents if they're trained on that kind of material, right? But also I can see that if they're being fed just what we've already done, you're going to get a cut and paste exercise where innovation isn't happening as much if you're just copying what went before, right? So that's kind of a multi-layered question, but I just wonder if you can address those issues as you were thinking about how do I build an agent that might be possibly innovative, not just copying what was there before, and taking inputs into a consideration that maybe traditionally in drug development we haven't been particularly good at doing in the past.
Yeah, that's 100% correct. And I think that's a great question. So, and I would say that, the answer is that's a work in progress for us, at least for Project Lumen. I know it's a work in progress for a lot of other people who are thinking in this space. Obviously, when you build these agents and you direct them towards certain places to gather, knowledge or to sort of learn from or train or whatever you want to call it. You can sort of weigh, what they use first, and you can weigh some things. And so in our Project Loom experiment, there were a few things that were considered, ground truths that I had to go and inform some of the documents, whether it be protocols, some of the subsequent things. And those are, if you will, weighed, 100% or 1.0, this has to be this way. The simplest thing is to think about is like the trial, the title of your trial. Like you don't want that agent to recreate something every time and be necessarily super creative there. Once you've locked in a trial, title, you want to, the name of the trial, you kind of want to stick with that, right? Or the name of the PI or the whatever it might be. And then afterwards, you can have a lot of other places where you can sort of dial up and down, if you will, how much creativity is in the agent process when it comes to creating a document. And by creativity, it really comes down to how much it weighs relative sources and uses them more or less to inform what it does. So there's a lot of opportunity to sort of try to balance that. The other thing I think that, we learned is because the output, let's talking about a protocol, but also talking about some of the other, many, many artifacts that are generated as part of a clinical trial and where this kind of input might really matter, right? The protocol obviously is critical, but a lot of other things, family or patient input would really matter. Because the agents are so fast, the ability to revise, right? The ability to get somebody else's feedback, the ability to say, can you redraft this, but, weigh more heavily the consideration of feasibility of the schedule of assessment for a family, that kind of stuff that for the room full of, old people writing a protocol requires reconvening that room in a month or in 2 months or in however long it might take with the AI agent is a 5-minute process. And so it may not be that we can completely revolutionize how these things get written. And to your point, I think to your question, we do still require, a balancing of different types of considerations. And if we stay with the old considerations, we will get something that looks very similar to the old protocols. But one advantage is that you can so rapidly redraft the protocol, redraft another artifact with slightly different considerations, give them more weight, that you can just see what happens. And a lot of that was Project Loom was that. It was, let's just see what happens. And quite frankly, see what happens by both humans reading different versions of protocol, but also having AI read them and having AI, use rubrics and scoring systems or whatever to tell you whether or not one document or the other, say an ICF, was more easily to understand, less easy to understand, weighed the safety, considered the safety more, made the safety sound more serious or less serious, all these kinds of things that have a big impact on trials.
Great, thank you. Jane.
I want to go back for a sec and ask you a little bit more about how you chose the protocol that you decided to simulate and what were the factors that you were thinking about. Like, I'm making this up. Was this a trial that was super hard to execute in real life and you wanted to see how it could go differently in an AI simulation? Or was it a trial in a domain where you have a super layer of data so you could feed the agents all sorts of information? So that's part one. Then part two, I'm very curious to know, as this was a simulation, was there an IRB involved or not? And if so, how did that work with the agents and with your humans in your team? And what did you learn?
So it's a good question. Maybe I'll take the second part first because it's going to be a little bit quicker. So the IRB was not involved in the sense of us needing an IRB to execute the project. However, the IRB was involved because obviously in the clinical trial operations workflow, getting IRB submissions and approval is a huge milestone and huge step. And so our platform did include a so-called IRB submission agent, and the task of that agent was to prepare an IRB submission, in our case, to the Duke or the DCRI IRB, which is what we used as an example. So our platforms, which as I mentioned before, were these orchestrated agents that sat on the platforms of these two vendor technology partners that we had. That platform connected into some other systems, and one of those systems was the Duke IRB. And so what it did is once it was ready, the agent was trained to say what is enough information, what are enough documents, what are enough whatever to submit to an IRB. The agent packaged those documents and sent them to the Duke IRB. Now, we did not then take those documents, which were an agent-created protocol, an agent-created ICF, an agent-created, recruitment plan, et cetera, et cetera. We did not take those documents to a full IRB board and say, is this an ethical study for this drug product or whatever. In the context of the Project Loom sort of experiment. But what we did do is we took that package of an IRB submission to an IRB administrative reviewer and say, is this complete? Can you use this to actually send this in front of an IRB board and evaluate the ethics of the trial and the ICF and so on and so forth? And it actually did that remarkably well. And you could argue that the criticism of our approach there is that we used the Duke IRB, so it's a little bit of an internal, process, and we'd love the opportunity to test that more for going forward with external IRBs, right? A little bit more rigorously. But it was successful in that regard, and the administrative reviewer did confirm that yes, all the pieces were there to technically submit this agent submitted IRB package or send it, I should say, to a board. So that's the IRB answer. We didn't need IRB to actually execute our simulation because it was all simulation, and quite frankly, the simulated virtual participants was like me. In the trial, but we did have IRB as part of the agent platform, and specifically had an agent that connected into the IRB to sort of enable an automated process of submission for IRB review. Now, as far as the choice of the protocol for the simulation, I would argue, sadly, all trials are kind of difficult to execute, but don't think this one was particularly. It was not a salvage or a rescue sort of scenario of a trial. This was a trial that completed, was run by a great team at DCRI. I know they worked really hard to get it done, but they got it done the way they wanted it to. What we were looking for when it came to a protocol to test in simulation was one, we wanted something that was completed, right? So we could really have all of the artifact, we could have the final result, we could compare everything to the agent or to the agent platform outputs. That was number one. Number two, we wanted a protocol that was relatively recent because things changed so much that some considerations, may no longer apply, et cetera. And then number three, we wanted to have a few things in the trial that we thought were important features that operationally matter. And some of those were, it had to be an intervention, in this case was drug versus standard of care, experimental drug versus standard of care, randomized controlled trial. Obviously, it was sort of a phase three study. We wanted it to have a combination of what we would typically think of as sort of inpatient data collection and primarily a clinical trial like site team data collection from the EHR, from clinical care in the hospital, and then a component of patient-reported outcomes, which this trial had. And then the third thing is we tried to have a timeline for the trial that was not like 12 months, because we did shrink the duration of trial participation artificially when we ran our simulation just for feasibility reasons. But we wanted that shrinking to be reasonable. And if we go from a 12-month trial to like 2 days, we're probably distorting the trials in ways that the simulation is no longer relevant. This was a 7-day intervention period that we shrunk to 2 days for feasibility reasons, just for the calendar. But we felt that that shrinking was still, stayed within sort of reason of the trial. So those are the main considerations. I would say that our therapeutic area expertise didn't matter as much because we did not train the agent specifically on that therapeutic area in any way. As an aside, we're actually doing that now because one thing we see is the potential for these platforms is to have them be more individualized for a certain group of trials, a network, a sponsor, whatever you want. And so we're working on that now to see what the difference is. But on this first iteration of Project Loom, the platform was trained in general for clinical trials, and it was not specific training for that therapeutic area.
Christoph, anything surprise you in this process so far? Is there anything that you thought would be a slam dunk that just was a complete flop, or maybe the other way around?
I mean, plenty of, it was all surprises in the sense that we didn't really know what to expect at all. And I'm relatively, I don't know if I'm pessimistic, but I'm always, I like to see it happen, right? I'm not a, yeah, you got to show proof matters. And so in this case, I was sort of at the onset expecting that things would go really poorly. And honestly, I was expecting that the quality of what the agents would be able to generate wasn't that good, in part because we built the platform very quickly. And we exactly trust and verify. But we very quickly, we built a platform very quickly, and we really focused on the idea of orchestration. So we were less focused on we have to write a perfect protocol, whatever that means, and we have to fine-tune this agent until the protocol is perfect. Or we have to do, a perfect IRB submission, and we have to fine-tune that agent until it's perfect. What I was much more interested is the idea of having being able to say, this agent wrote a protocol, and this agent knows what is needed for an IRB submission, and they can somehow figure it out between each other when everything is there so we can submit to an IRB. That piece to us, I think, was a lot more of the intriguing piece because the ability to refine agents becomes a lot easier once you have that platform, that orchestration. You can show that that works, and the individual pieces need to be made better, whether that's with other agents or, quite frankly, whether that's simply with human input, because it doesn't, again, have to replace human input. You can get a first draft of the protocol that's pretty good, and then you take an experienced trialist or an experienced clinical trial operational leader to make to take it from pretty good to perfect, and you submit it. So, that said, that what surprised us the most, I think ultimately the quality of some of the documents was really surprising. The best one, as measured by sort of assessment of humans and assessment using AI as an evaluator against rubrics, were the ICFs. And to Amir's prior questions, the ICFs were actually very good at writing content in a language and a language level that was at least perceived against certain rubrics to be much closer to what it should be for patients to understand than, oftentimes I think human written ICFs turn out. The protocol was also very good, a little bit less in terms of sort of quality if you want to sort of compare apples to oranges and the ICF, but I thought the quality of the document was really surprising. I was surprised at the IRB submission sort of process. I thought surely that was not going to work, and then the reviewer would come back and say it's missing half of the stuff that we would need, and that was not the case. And then later on in the operational process, we uploaded synthetic EHR data, and the agents were very good at writing case report forms for the EDC, which they did and created, and then populating those with the synthetic EHR data. And the accuracy of that data extraction was extremely high. Although I think the caveat there is that the synthetic data was very clean and in its format very consistent, which obviously helps tremendously. The biggest fail, and the one fail that actually in our simulation experiment resulted in the need for an unplanned human intervention, was interestingly enough pre-screening. So when it came to identifying participants for the trial, the agent platform was fed a list of people with very basic information like age and gender. And it was tasked with finding, among it was 1,000 people, obviously all simulated people, 1,000 people. It was tasked with finding the 30 that were eligible for a study simulation, and it failed at doing that. And it was almost like a step that we thought when we built the platform was so simple that we just almost glossed over it and said, let's move on to building case report forms, right? Let's move on to extract data from the EHR, because we all knew that's a big problem. And so I think that highlights the importance of testing. Because some things that you think would be really simple, may actually turn out not to be, and vice versa.
Do you think that chart review gap was because of it needed more therapeutic area specific training, or were the eligibility criteria really coarse that it should have been a no-brainer?
It should have been a no-brainer. I think it was really a technical agent design programming piece, and I think it's one that's easily surmountable. But again, I think it just highlights if you are a clinical trialist, if your organization thinking about sponsoring a clinical trial, knowing what the agents do is really, really key. And I think that our partners are fantastic, and our technology partners were unbelievable in terms of how quickly they built this and how strong the platforms are that they both built. But it shows that there's sometimes things that the agents do that you have to have somebody really understand each step and understand the logic. And not always everything is, artificial intelligence in the sense of like who knows what's happening. Some of it is very logical and very traceable, right? In terms of like how the agent goes from this step to the next. And it remains really important for some human to trace back that logic and make sure there's no gaps. I think that's really what it came down to.
I So,
think
Christoph, if go ahead, Donald, you want to
I
say
was
this?
going to say it reinforced for us what we've heard a lot about AI recently in the news as well, which is that AI is a tool. And not, it's not going to, especially in clinical trials, it's highly regulated and very patient focused. We have to think about the humans and the sort of intuition that goes with that and the contextual components that AI in our case was really a tool, a great tool, but just a tool.
Sure, I think Donna, we still don't. Some people don't realize how good the human brain is, and there's no way none of them can replicate that. Christoph, I would say from what you're describing, one of the phrases I currently use for our current AIs is like an idiot savant. So they may know a lot, but sometimes they can act like idiots. So you mentioned your personal experience with AI. I'm assuming you have the same experience what I do, which is at times it's remarkable how good it can be and more sophisticated than you expect. At other times it fails tying up its shoelaces. Like, so it's kind of interesting. But I just wondered if I can frame what you were trying to do. Am I right in thinking, again, like you said, it's a work in progress. This was a kind of demonstration project. Nothing was supposed to be perfect. You're just showing whether orchestration is possible. Is the idea here to really, I would say, you could call it democratization, you can call it reducing barrier to entry, you could call it demystifying. Is this a way for entities like ones Craig really enjoys sort of championing, which is like, say, groups for the certain diseases when they run their own trials? Is this a way where you can actually maybe start developing protocols and programs without having to have, the expertise of, large organizations? Is that kind of where this might end up being enabled by the work you're doing?
Yes, the short answer is yes. The longer answer is that I think one of the great things about this platform is it can be different things for different people. And it's a starting place. And, it shows what's possible in terms of development. And you could see do very different things. You could see fine-tuning this platform of agents for a type of clinical trial that, say, for example, a network would do. And you would just hyper train it on your therapeutic area, on your processes, and it would become just very, very good, high throughput, put out a whole bunch of stuff, very quickly, all kind of in one pipeline. You could see it as a place for like all sorts of experimentation, right? So the other end, I mentioned that, we didn't do like a complete clinical trial, complete, because I don't even know what that means. Every trial is different. You could see a scenario where this platform is a place where you plug in all sorts of widgets and things that you might need in a clinical trial, or that you think you might need, and you use simulation at much, much bigger scale than what we did, right? Thousands and thousands of iterations of your protocol, right? Running the trial thousands and thousands of times to see what causes it to break, right? And maybe it's the connection with some vendor, a tool-derived data that causes a problem, or maybe it's some inability to connect in time, a participant between one sort of data collection point with a chatbot to another one again with a tool or with an at-home device for, some sampling or whatever it might be. So there's a completely different sort of framework for this for some people who are thinking, we have this trial coming up, it's going to be huge, it's a massive investment, it's a big, it lets you simulation on this platform to really see what might happen, and and then sort of tune the platform to look very differently. But certainly, to your question, to me personally, this idea of being able to democratize clinical trials for patient groups, families, for people like myself who are just like doctors trying to get some answers and who will never get the answer to the question that they have simply because nobody will ever pay for that trial. If that platform existed in such a way that we could ensure that ethically, safely, we can really run a simple clinical trial, right? Nothing too sophisticated, in many of these contexts, and do that over and over and over again. The potential, I think, impact for evidence generation for our field would be huge. Not for pharma to approve the next drug or the next device, but just to get some answers for patients and for those people who are trying to provide patient with answers. I think that would be a huge benefit, and that's certainly something that I could see being possible. And I know of some people, including companies like biotechs, who are not exactly the same as what I just talked about, but still are somewhat resource constrained, maybe, or taking risks. There are some biotechs out there that are doing that right now, not with our platform, but with similar products. And I think they're doing that successfully, and that's pretty cool.
I think this really speaks to the that potential for strategies like these to democratize clinical research and expand the funnel of who is able to generate evidence. Are there futures here on the horizon where institutions like Duke that have therapeutic candidates that they are discovering and typically then have to license out to pharmaceutical companies for evidence generation just because of the economics of clinical development? Are there instances in the future where some academic centers may be able to hold on to some of those select assets or take on assets themselves that biopharma just doesn't find commercially returnable, but are still meaningful for patients? And there are these opportunities emerging to, generate that evidence much more efficiently. But Christoph, I'm curious in our last few minutes here, like where this all goes for from here for Project Loom, because I would imagine, this is an interesting academic exercise to be able to amplify and share. This is a great learning opportunity for the tech companies that were involved in partnering with iCubed, where they've hopefully developed some great real-world experience that can help them on their journeys to be able to bring more high impact products into the market. Maybe there are opportunities to incubate capabilities in the gaps in the white space for Project Loom and iCubed around orchestration or other areas. Maybe this is a service for Duke and iCubed going forward. So I'm curious, in your mind, what's next on the roadmap here?
And I'll let Donna maybe chime in after my answer here as well on this topic. But the answer is yes to all the things you just mentioned. I think that I can tell you what we're currently doing and maybe what we would love to see happen. This idea of democratizing trials to me is really what it comes to with this platform. And so making it a service for that reason is important. And we're working with our technology partners right now to sort of figure out exactly what that looks like and how to best do that. I think I mentioned several times in my answers, this was a first pilot, right? It is not perfect. I don't think it has to be because, human work is not perfect either, and it doesn't replace human work. It sort of augments the human capability. So it's okay for a platform to not be perfect, but obviously you want it to be as good as possible. So we're working on improving some of its aspects right now with other demonstration projects, etc. And I think the third thing is the expanded capabilities. The idea of having a platform was that, the orchestration of however many agents we build, it was many, many dozens. But, there's always more agents you can add to it. And so we are working right now on projects to refine some of the existing agents, customize and fine-tune them to different sponsor needs, adding more capabilities to some of them, including the IRB, for example. And so our hope is that over time, the platform can gradually become better and better, that we have a pathway to make it accessible for people so that we can achieve this democratization sort of goal, and that we can continue to think of use cases for it to show with some of the other potentials, like I mentioned, simulation of trials at a bigger scale, risk assessment of trials and some of those things, which are going to be more continued, I think, academic, exercises rather than direct deployment. But Don, I don't know if you want to add to that, if you have other thoughts, because I think many of us have different ideas of what we could do next. There's lots of opportunities.
Yeah, I mean, I think we always try to sort of center around our original goal at iCubed, which is to, make clinical trials faster, more affordable, more efficient, and more inclusive, more open to more people. And so that, at the end of the day, that's what we're looking towards. That's the first part. The second thing I would say is that, like anything, when you sort of go down a road towards, identifying a solution or working on a project, you almost always find other opportunities. And so that has led us in a lot of different directions for iCubed and for Loom specifically. And one of them was what Christoph was mentioning earlier, is that this has particular utility for networks. So groups of therapeutic areas and or regions, geographic regions, things like that, that we can, if we can group trials and then be able to provide a solution that makes sense, even in the case, Craig, at rare disease, is there an opportunity here where we could really make the seeking out therapeutics for a rare disease much more streamlined because you're able to pull a lot of very specific data in. And so, we've had a lot of sort of forks in the road, and sometimes it means going both ways, not just not having to pick one or the other. And that's what's happened here. There's a lot of offshoots from this.
Donna, as an operational person, are you excited to have a bunch of people working? Did they take no days off? They don't go to bed
Right.
around the clock. How does that feel for you?
Yeah, I mean, as Christoph sort of alluded to earlier, it's a balance, because we have amazing people who work in our organization, and we all the goal of this is really to augment their work and to be able to help them shine. And if you use AI, personally, that that's a little bit of a dance. You can certainly learn a lot from your AI agent on your phone, but you also have to augment it with your own judgment and your own, the things that you make you unique. And that's true for our teams. We really value our, clinical trial professionals, but we want them to be doing the things that they're good at, not, chasing paper.
Sure.
And
So
so,
I have
and
two future.
they like that. They like that.
Absolutely. I have two future-looking questions around that for you, both of you. One is, I think that's great. I think anyone would prefer not to be doing kind of the routine stuff and, get it done faster. I guess my question is, what happens when those people are aging out and we don't have a whole new generation of people who've done the boring stuff and understand those things? And then the internet goes down, the agents don't work, and we have no humans who kind of understand that. So that's one thing to think about, right? What are we doing for young people? Because there aren't going to be that entry level or people understanding all those processes because we're using agents. means for all of it. That's one question I think about. The other one is, as we saw ChatGPT go rogue and start hacking things and stuff, my joke to someone was, oh, maybe the agents can now go and hack us EHRs and get data we're not allowed to have and enroll patients we didn't usually have access to, even more successful. So how do you think about those two things? Kind of, ensuring the knowledge is there in humans is in some level, and ensuring the sort of the cybersecurity of things.
I mean, I could just real start and then Christoph, you can add to it. I mean, I would say, right now we still believe that the clinical trial steps and the clinical trial processes is the framework, the baseline, the structure for all of our clinical development today. And our, the professionals that come into the DCRI and to other organizations need to know those steps and what they are. And again, this is, AI is a help along the way. And, people throw around the human in the loop thing, terminology, but it's a real thing. We have to have that human judgment as part of this process when you're dealing with data and humans and other things. And so we feel very strongly about that and have, put together some real clear barriers around that so that we can make sure that we're delivering. Christoph, did you have anything to add on to that?
Yeah, I think on the I mean, on the first question about the workforce, I think it's based in sort of a workforce development and after 2025 or whatever sort of question, right? And I think there is some real work to be done there as the tools become clearer. And there's a time, like you said, there's a there's it's not super urgent, but it's kind of urgent because you can't lose the knowledge base and the experience of sort of the prior generation completely. So there is a real question about workforce development and what that looks like. To me, though, there's precedent for this. I think the idea that AI takes away somebody's job and completely, like, there's a little bit of fantasy there too, and it's not, it's a technology that's potentially, by some measure, maybe more powerful than like the electronic data capture system. But, in some ways, when the electronic data capture system came along, there were things that needed to be done that were very different than paper records, and people had to be retrained or had to learn, and yet somehow when the EDC went down, there were paper records somewhere to complete. And so I'm not saying it's exactly the same; it's a little bit more complicated, and I don't want me to oversimplify, but I do think that basically the task is when you now bring in somebody, and I think as Jane pointed out in the chat here, for those who can see this, that maybe there's an interest for people who are digitally more native to get more excited in this sooner. I think when those people come along, the training will have to be a combination. This is what the agent actually does. This is the process. This is what it looks like in the human form. And then, yeah, you're lucky that the agent does this for you and screens through this list and can find people. But it's still your job to again go verify that the list is correct and whatever. So it's really it's a task for some of the current workforce managers to figure out how to train. As far as the cybersecurity, I think I'm not smart enough or qualified enough to answer that question, other than to say that I think it's a big deal. Now, the idea of, and again, we have not really explored that too much in Project Loom because our electronic health records were synthetic and structured, and quite frankly, the synthetic electronic health record nature was a necessity, not a desire, just to get this done. But there's quite the interest, and there are many people smarter than me working on this of trying to figure out how AI can help us solve this EHR to EDC problem. And I'm very confident that that's going to happen. And whether that's because it hacks better or whether it's because people ultimately allow it to hack better or some combination thereof, I'm not sure, but there's definitely lots of future momentum there.
Christoph, DTRA is a community with biopharmaceutical companies, technology companies, academic groups, government agencies, CROs, and others. We have initiatives that our community wants to pursue around some of the gaps and challenges related to AI and agentic. Some of that can be, for example, when efforts like yours are trying to create handoffs, is there too much friction from one platform to the next? Do we need some sort of nomenclature to make those handoffs easier? Others might be for each of the use cases that you were pursuing, you had to develop rubrics to evaluate what good looked like? Should we be normalizing those rubrics and making them more widely available so that when organizations are benchmarking themselves, they can use similar language to benchmark against other projects? When you think about a consortia like DTRA, based on this experience with Project Loom, what do you think we should be doing next to make adoption easier?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that standards to evaluate quality, whatever exactly that means, it's easier to think about that when the output is a document and it has to have certain things in it that you can sort of test it. But when the agent executes a task, maybe measuring quality is more difficult. But thinking about specifically for agents that support clinical trial operations, which is what Project Loom was about, what are those measurements of quality and what would be sort of the reference minimum standard, right, for an agent to be considered appropriate for use in a clinical trial. I think that's a huge task. And there's just tons of bias for people who are developing these tools or testing these tools in when they're doing this, and that present company included. So I think having an organization like DTRA help with that, I think would be huge. The interface question and sort of friction with other, that's a really interesting question. Again, I'm not smart enough to know how to answer that. I think it just depends on what people do with the agents, So, for example, in Loom, one of the interfaces I mentioned was the IRB, and we're right now working on an agent to sort of augment that capability. And what it comes down to is it matters a lot what's on the receiving end for that agent. Like, what kind of IRB system are you trying to submit to? And if that system asks questions, ABC versus question XYZ at its submission, the agent has to be able to sort of handle that, and the technical pieces in addition to that are very different. So similarly, when we created case report forms, populated them, and went and put them into an EDC, the EDC we used for Project Loom was DCRI's REDCap instance, for example, and they have one sort of form of interface with FHIR, et cetera. There's obviously others that exist. So the question of those friction points, I think the important thing there might be what could be connectors, right? What could be plugins that could go into an agent platform? And can there be some sort of a standard for, like, if you have a platform that generates some stuff with agents, it needs to be able to connect with the following things. And again, that's sort of a standard connectivity. I'm not sure technically what that would look like. Obviously, FHIR is a big one, but there's other things I think that would be potentially helpful. And then I think the third thing is the human interface. Donna mentioned humans in the loop, and it's more than that. It's, I think, and we had those very well defined in Project Loom, but I'm not sure that our definitions are correct. Clear human points of, like, verifications, clear gates, checkpoints where unless a human said yes, proceed with this, we would not proceed. Obviously, a final protocol is sort of a natural one everybody comes to think about, but there's others along the way, and getting some technical expertise, because we need some of that to define those human checkpoints, I think is another thing that would be really helpful.
That's really helpful insights there. And I know I caught you off guard with that question. I really appreciate the perspective because a lot of that really validates a lot of the insights we've been hearing, especially your first observation around whether we call them standards or benchmarks or frameworks that we can consistently use to evaluate quality and what good looks like here. All that being said, we are at the top of the hour, and I want to be mindful of your time and generosity in sharing your time and insights here today. So I would encourage folks in the community here, be sure to follow Christoph Hornick and Donna Parker online, on LinkedIn or otherwise. Keep track of their work and evolving work, both with Project Loom at projectloomisit.org, Christoph?
That's
Okay.
right.
And Donna, where do people find more about iCubed?
We also have a website, icubecenter.org.
There we go. So be sure to follow those. And remember, let us know here at DTRA if you've got a topic you'd love to see us cover in the weeks and months ahead. Thanks, everyone. Enjoy your weekend.
Thank you, Don and Christoph.
Thank you.